when people are getting killed around you, you're fighting a war.
If they're going to do that to us, we're going to do this to you. So you tell them to stop.
Everybody became a troubles junkie. Where was the next atrocity? Was it family? Was it friends?
It was just mayhem.
Northern Ireland was partitioned in 1921 by the British colonial authorities. Six counties in the north would remain part of the UK. The other 26 formed the Irish Free State, today known as the Republic of Ireland. The partition of Ireland immediately led to conflict, building on centuries of divide and rule strife between the Protestant and Catholic populations. But it was the denial of human rights to the Catholic minority by the post-partition administration in the north that sparked the long period of violent conflict in the 1960s.
There was a deeper side to it, as well as, a terrorist side.
Euphemistically known as the Troubles, it left 3,521 people dead. Many more bore the scars of the war.
Some of my best friends are killers.
At the end of the day, it will be the cutting edge of the IRA which will bring freedom.
I don't have any regrets for anything I've done. I believe that I was a part of a war, and that war had to be fought.
The historic Good Friday Agreement of 1998 brought the conflict to an end.
After a generation of bloodshed, George Mitchell ushers in what the whole island hopes will be a new era of peace.
Friends in England ask, isn't it all sorted since the ceasefires? But all sorted, it is not.
Loyalists in Northern Ireland actually feel they haven't gained anything from a peace process.
3,000 plus people dead was a hell of a price to pay just to become a part of the state you were supposedly trying to overthrow.
It was a remarkable moment for peace. But today, the Good Friday Agreement faces acute challenges.
Brexit has the potential to break up the British state. It offers Irish Republicans an opportunity to realise a reunification of the Irish nation. And as history teaches us, it will inevitably stoke the fires of resistance against British rule in Ireland.
There's no question that these Brextremists, in their hardline support for a particular dogmatic position of Brexit, are actually playing with fire. They're endangering the peace process.
Nowhere are the stakes of Brexit and Remain higher than in the north of Ireland. But nowhere is perhaps less well understood in Britain than the island next door. This is a special edition of the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper from the LSE, and my co-host Zoe Williams from The Guardian. We went to Northern Ireland partly to confront our own ignorance, and in part to find the human side of the Irish border, or what many still refer to as the British border in Ireland. This podcast is our attempt to explain what we learnt. The podcast will be broadcast in two parts. In part one, we explore the bloody history of conflict and the continuing problem of segregation today.
You know, I've never been to Northern Ireland before, and it's quite embarrassing.
Why?
Well, I was in Vienna and talking to a Croatian, Serbian, Yugoslav colleague, and we were talking about the Irish border in Northern Ireland, and I was like, yeah, I've never actually been. And he just laughed and went, don't worry, like, most Serbs have never been to Kosovo either. I'm meant to be like this informed person, but I've never been to this place. Oh yeah, sorry, we need to get off here.
Yeah, can the records show that I'm used to a higher standard of navigation?
So we just had this incredibly deep conversation with the car rental guy.
He asked if we were on the Remain side, and when we said we were, he said he would give us any help we needed. Which is exactly what you want to hear from a car rental guy anyway.
And then it turned out that he was a unionist, but a very liberal unionist who votes for the DUP and, in his words, opposes everything they stand for apart from the union with the UK because he's British. It was remarkable because he was just an incredibly liberal bloke.
It was really interesting in how clear he was on the matter of the border, you know.
Yeah.
Cannot have a border because the only maintenance of peace is because people who are English can be English, people who are British can be British, and people who are Irish can be Irish. I don't even know if I've heard that so clearly articulated before.
He also, like, the total, city centre, the sort of total openness that suits both sides.
It's been really interesting, the trajectory of Westminster politics, because the whole of the referendum, they never mention the Irish border. The whole of the kind of triggering of Article 50, nobody mentioned the Irish border. It took the EU to bring it up before it even became a bone of contention. And then once it was a bone of contention, it immediately went to people like Owen Paterson saying, oh, we'll be fine, there's a tech solution.
Yeah.
And everybody pretending they had a huge amount of expertise about it. But actually, what got leapfrogged in that process was anybody actually saying why a hard border would be so damaging. But of course, if your peace is maintained by everybody being able to maintain any national identity they choose in the moment, then of course an actual border would be catastrophic for that.
And it was really clear from his description of the sort of human element that this is a post-sovereignty space in a way, because the border's open and that's all been enabled by the EU. And I mean, it was interesting, the guy said, you know, lots of my mates who are unionist are voting Alliance Party now. He even described his daughter in a relationship with a Sinn Féin voter.
What I thought was interesting about that vignette, his daughter, listener, is called Darcy, and I don't know what her boyfriend is called. The boyfriend is a Sinn Féin voter, as Luke said. I said, why can't he just vote Alliance in order to get a Remain candidate in Westminster, considering Sinn Féin won't take their seat? And he said, oh, it doesn't work like that. If you're in that area, you vote Sinn Féin. And I said, well, how does anybody know? It's a secret ballot. He was just shaking his head because it doesn't work like that.
He was sort of laughing at us.
Yeah, he was sort of laughing in our faces.
Oh, you naive London metropolitans.
But I still don't really understand that.
Driving around the border regions of Northern Ireland today, it is difficult to imagine the intensity of its violent history. Everyday life in border areas like Newry and South Armagh was entirely different then to how it is now. Today it is outwardly familiar for British visitors. Newry has all the look and feel of a small prosperous town. There are few boarded up shops and no visible signs of the military conflicts of the last century. Mickey Brady, who is today the Sinn Féin MP for the area, described growing up in a society that was, to all intents and purposes, subject to military rule.
For people of my generation, it seemed wrong in a sense, because I was born just and reared just over the street that we're sitting in here. And you would walk out your door and some guy with in a British uniform, a Birmingham accent or a Scouser would ask you where you were coming from and personal details, dates of birth, and you did resent it. Because you wonder, what's all this about, you know? So there was a resentment, and this idea that has been perpetrated, and I actually listened to a gay British Army commander on the radio the other day saying that they were brought in to maintain peace and all of that. I mean, I never found necessarily that to be the case. I always found them to be more than aggressive. I remember, as I said, working in Butlins and Skegness in 1969 and coming back, and things were really starting to... We came back, I think, in late August 69, where the British Army had moved in, and I remember driving through Belfast to go to Newry, and you could just sense that things had changed, and you had Army roadblocks, and then you went into areas where you had residence roadblocks and all of that. So you realise very quickly things had changed, you know.
What's a residence roadblock?
Well, you know, people would have put up roadblocks because there had been maybe a bit of rioting in the area. I mean, back if you go back to 69, then you had pogroms, basically. You had the Lincoln Base Street and that, which was burnt out, you know. So people from Belfast then were coming through Newry literally as refugees and going on to the south. So a lot of people in Newry were involved in organising transport, organising food and all of that, and places for people to stay, particularly going towards Dundalk. And there was a lot of people stayed in Gormanston initially, which was just up near Drogheda. So, I mean, all of that was happening. So I think it started to dawn on people very quickly that this situation was different. Again, I would go back to my childhood when there was an IRA campaign called Operation Harvest from 1956 to 1962. So in this street, I mean, there was a garage just around the corner here where there's a transformer beside it. That was blown up. The electricity board office, which was around the corner from where I lived, that was blown up. And you had a curfew. The B-men, the B-specials, there was a curfew after 11 o'clock. They could literally be shot. You know, so you had all of that happening when I was very, very young, and then it developed into the military presence from 1969 onwards. So all of that was kind of developing, you know. So it led to, I suppose, for a lot of people locally here, resentment. You know, and also, to me, often the causes of the conflict have never been fully addressed. Why did it happen, you know? And one of the reasons it happened was because we were being treated as second-class citizens. That's pure and simple. We didn't have the same rights. We didn't have the same voting rights. We didn't have the same rights in any sense, you know? And there was always that thought, particularly in an area like Newry, where people, I mean, Newry and Strabane were the two nationalist-controlled councils in the six counties, and yet both of them had the highest unemployment.
This BBC film crew followed a British Army patrol in South Armagh in 1976.
Forward space, forward arm. Release spring. Charge magazine, load.
This Royal Scots patrol is about to set up a checkpoint on the roads outside the town.
You probably know that New Hamptons was a bomb village in Northern Ireland. It's had so many car bombs, and the devastation in the town itself is just unbelievable. There's something like one out of every 10 buildings left standing, and the other 9 are just rubble that's lying about the streets.
What do you think life is like for them?
Well, it can't be much. I mean, they're stopped at a barrier when they go out in the morning. When they come home from work in the evening, they're stopped at a barrier and their car searched. But they just seem to be up with it, they adapt to it. So it doesn't worry them anymore, or it doesn't seem to anyway.
The militarisation of Northern Ireland took hold in force in the 1970s. It went hand in hand with a shift to armed conflict and away from civil rights movements. Many young men joined the IRA after the Bloody Sunday massacre of 1972 in the Bogside area of Derry. On that day, British Army troops killed 14 unarmed protesters in one of the most infamous moments in the Troubles.
Factions in the Catholic community united against internment under the banner of civil rights.
But in its initial rise, the civil rights movement was a moment of hope. They confronted the discrimination of Irish Catholics, promoting equality and human rights.
It is obvious that the Unionist Party is quite prepared to set Catholic against Protestant in this country, rather than give the reforms which would in fact mean that there would be an end to sectarianism.
I think for myself, as somebody who was still at school when the civil rights movement started in 68, 69, and that was a kind of an exciting time because you had the whole student revolution going on, and you had Tariq Ali in Britain, you had the students in Paris, you had Red Rudy in Germany, and you had all of that kind of thing happening. You had the civil rights movement in America with Martin Luther King and unfortunately being assassinated, and Bobby Kennedy both in 1968. So there's that whole kind of groundswell, I suppose, of awareness, maybe for the like of myself, who was still, you know, just about to do A-levels and that. In Uri here, there's some leading up to 69. The first big march in Uri was on the 11th of January, 69, which then developed into, I suppose, a riot situation, really. And in a sense, that was quite exciting as a young person. Certainly civil rights was something that struck a chord, I think, with everybody, because living in Uri, Uri has always been a tolerant. I mean, there's never been really the kind of community or sectarian strife that you would have in other places like Portadown and Lurgan and places like that. There was an element, possibly, but a small element in Uri, and we were lucky in that sense, you know, and both communities were able to engage and intermix and all of that. In terms of what happened with the civil rights movement, as I said, there was a kind of exciting thing about it. It sort of galvanised people, and some great meetings in Uri to sort of explain why civil rights movement was started, the empathy with civil rights movement in America with different parts of Europe. And of course then, you know, people here would have remembered the uprising in Hungary in 1956, because that would have been something that people talked about to some degree as well. So you had all of that happening.
Katie Haywood is a sociologist at Queen's University Belfast. She is an expert on the peace process in Northern Ireland and how it has been shaped by the European Union. We asked her to show us some of the peace walls in Belfast. We drove through security gates, to this day closed at certain times of the week to keep the communities apart, and parked up in increasingly poor weather as the interview went on, looking out on one of the walls. To read about it is one thing, but to actually see a peace wall is quite another, because, I mean, it must be 25 or 30 metres high. It's much larger, much more imposing than I imagined. And, it changes the character of the space completely, because you feel like this isn't a place where people live. Like the Troubles, a peace wall is also a euphemism. Some might say even a contradiction in terms.
Perhaps a better phrase would be peace barriers or barricades, because originally the peace walls were put up as temporary structures, and this was in response to the violence that was occurring mainly in Belfast at the beginning of the Troubles, so the late 1960s, early 1970s. Alongside this, you had people having to be evacuated from their houses. We had this sort of, if you like, a form of ethnic cleansing that was going on within the city, with different parts of the city becoming associated with particular communities. And there were riots that would occur between communities, and also, of course, between local communities and the police and the security forces. So barricades were put up really as a defence for local communities, and then over time, as certain parts of the city became associated with certain communities, those began to take on a more substantial form, and really they were seen as forms of protection. And you can see the continuity of that all the way through to today, in that many people who live in areas very close to peace walls see them as a form of protection and they don't want them to come down. And if you look at certain peace walls, you can see it began as a wall and then it had a fence put on top of that and then barbed wire put on top of that, so that the height of them have grown to sort of respond to some of the violence that was occurring, and it may well just be, you know, things being thrown over, etc. But they've become more substantial over time.
So was some of the kind of very intense sectarianism, you know, mm-hmm. some areas very associated with one community or another, was that actually quite artificial? A small amount of violence had intensified the ghettoisation.
Yes, so this was in the very start of the Troubles. Obviously, you had growing suspicions between communities. There was a sense of vulnerability. So if you're a minority with only a small number of you from, say, the Catholic community in a certain area, then you'd feel vulnerable and you'd be targeted, you know. And it might just be, sort of what we term now as sort of antisocial behaviour. But because of that background of paramilitarism and then the growing violence of the Troubles, people simply felt a safety in being with the dominant community from which they originate. But also there were very active, efforts made by paramilitary organisations on both sides to intimidate people out of their homes, direct warnings given, etc. So the peace walls today, you have some walls obviously that are fixed, and then you have barriers as well. So there are some roads can be blocked if needs be at a certain time, and oftentimes they would be associated with, you know, contentious parades, for example.
So that still goes on. People still think of them as protective against violence.
Yeah. And so that's why you can, you know, some of these, you know, you can have gates that are open, like the one we're on now, Cooper Way. You can drive through that peace wall, but at certain times, those gates would be closed and you simply couldn't cross this wall, you know, get through from one side to the other. So you'd have to go a very roundabout way to get across. So, for example, I've done some research on contentious parades in Ardoyne in North Belfast, and that's the 12th of July. And getting back into South Belfast from North Belfast, for example, would require a very circuitous route, not just to avoid the parades, but also to manage the fact that some of these peace walls are closed and literally the roads are blocked.
There is a particular lack of understanding of Ireland and the country's colonial history in general in Britain. But Katie explained how the post-peace generation in the north of Ireland often have to learn these tangled histories too.
For local students, you know, unless they come from near a peace wall in Belfast, which is would be unusual, I have to say, there isn't necessarily a detailed knowledge and understanding of what the Troubles was about, partly because, well, this isn't the case for every family, but in many cases, the parents don't want to burden their children with the awfulness of the Troubles, and so they, you know, almost afraid of repeating that history. And so actually even the next generation of people who've, you know, been in Northern Ireland all their lives, it's a bit of a shock when they come and see the peace walls and then they hear from Loyalist and Republican former prisoners. So what I'm saying is, I think, don't be... Obviously, in England, there's a particular lack of understanding, but it's also here as well in some ways.
There's also this argument slash statistic that's raised in these discussions about the walls, mm-hmm. that there are more now since the Good Friday Agreement than there were previously. Mm-hmm. And that seems like an incredibly shocking thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was in Vienna earlier this year professionally, there were quite a few people in the academic institution that I was based at who were working on the Balkans and working in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And they said they found it quite shocking going to Belfast because they were really surprised. And Bosnia, by the way, is not in a good way at the moment, a different conversation. But they thought it was really shocking, the number and scale of the walls. So it's not just a historical thing, it's also a contemporary problem of community cohesion too, right?
Yes. So Northern Ireland is very segregated. Belfast is a very segregated city, particularly North and West Belfast, and the peace walls are just a manifestation of that. And the Good Friday Belfast Agreement created the environment, obviously, for sustaining the ceasefires and for, you know, having devolved politics, etc., and giving democratic legitimacy to the politics in Northern Ireland. But at the same time, it also reinforced, if you like, the idea of two communities.
No.
Because it actually uses a phrase, both communities, two traditions.
Right.
So it talks about communities with, you know, their different ethos, values, political aspirations, etc. So it's putting forward this interpretation of Northern Ireland society as being very, in which there's a clear binary divide.
But from your point of view, the answer to that wouldn't be to torpedo the Good Friday Agreement?
Oh, no, absolutely not. What it was a sort of, it was the beginning, it created the architecture in political terms for what was needed, but it wasn't ground level. It certainly wasn't an agreement that was sort of from the bottom up, didn't really address grassroots. So from that point on, there's been more initiatives to try and address societal segregation. But you're dealing with the fact that you have institutions that are highly segregated, most obviously the schooling system. So only something like 7% of children are educated in integrated schools.
So it sounds like you're saying that division could be triggered by not very much. Is that fair?
So, for example, the Flags protest, which was 2012-13, when Belfast City Council voted to only fly the Union flag on certain days, which is pretty much the norm, I think, in the UK. But anyway, it was highly contentious that it wasn't flying 365 days in the year, and it fermented a sort of a loyalist protest that went on for a very long time. It doesn't take too much for people to begin to feel that things are unravelling, and this is why political leadership is so important. But in those moments, the peace walls would be a solace to some people, because they'd sort of feel, well, you know, if things do get fractious, if there is, you know, more rioting going on, if people are beginning to be targeted, I'm glad I'm behind that high wall.
So it isn't a kind of totemic sense of difficulties overcome. It's more a raw physical reality that you've got a wall.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. And it serves a purpose. A colleague of mine in Queens, Madeline Leonard, did a study on young people and peace walls. And the interesting thing was they were in North Belfast interviewing school children who have a peace wall literally through their school, basically through the school grounds. They don't notice it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just part of their daily life. They wouldn't, you know, even comment on it. They struggle to make them talk about the peace wall because they really just didn't even recognise that it was there. It was just part of daily life.
One of the defences you might make of the Good Friday Agreement would be that, okay, it in some ways cemented the divide between unionist and nationalist.
Yeah.
And that's encapsulated in the cross-community policy in the Stormont Assembly. But is not the response to that, well, look, political parties can identify, as Alliance does, and the Green Party, I think, in Northern Ireland does, mm-hmm. as of other or neither community, and it's in the gift of the Northern Irish communities to vote for those parties too. So you could imagine a Stormont Assembly where other mm-hmm. had the majority of seats, even within the terms mm-hmm. of the GFA. I don't know what you're just more curious what you would think about that.
So the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey, which is the most reliable form of public opinion data in Northern Ireland, that shows that 50% of people in Northern Ireland say they're neither unionist nor nationalist.
Interesting.
And is that the highest that's ever been?
Yes. It's never been higher.
Wow.
And that's particularly amazing. True of young people, but not exclusively so.
And connected to that, there's this trend of people identifying as Northern Irish and rather than British or Irish. Is that right?
So the trend would be amongst people who would say they're unionist or Protestant, they would say, yes, more of them saying they're Northern Irish rather than exclusively British. You don't see that on from those who are from a Catholic background.
Right,
they tend to say Irish.
Right.
But one thing I would emphasise is that amongst Catholics and Protestants, the majority of them see themselves as being a mix of British and Irish. So the groups that are exclusively Irish or exclusively British are not in the majority, actually. Most people say they're a bit of a mix, albeit, you know, mainly British or mainly Irish. So the picture is much more complicated. And this is why, but certainly true, not all Catholics are nationalists, for example, want a united Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
This is much more complicated than that. And although it was simplified for the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in order to get over the line, it's actually moving forward into a situation where you have a political system that better represents the diversity of identities here is difficult. So to answer your point about those, you know, if we have 50% who are neither, why aren't they voting for a party that is neither?
Yeah.
It's partly because the setup in the Assembly, and we've heard more about it recently with this debate about consent, means that those parties who don't designate as nationalist or unionist actually have slightly less weight in the Northern Ireland Assembly when it comes to certain votes.
How do you do that? I mean, that sounds like real casuistry.
It was an attempt to ensure that you have a mechanism for protecting minority views. So it comes from a background in which obviously you have persistent discrimination and prejudice against, you know, nationalists.
Mm-hmm.
And this was intended to ensure you do have cross-community consent. So if you're looking for cross-community consent, it's just almost presumed that those who are neither don't really count that much.
Yeah, I see.
You know, because they're already not going to cause any problems.
So it is kind of flawed in a sense. Obviously, everyone now, will ask you about the European context in a moment, is saying we must defend the Good Friday Agreement for very important reasons.
Yes.
But there's an important element of which it is a kind of flawed agreement in terms of moving beyond sectarian division.
Yes, it goes so far, but I think the assumption was, bear in mind it was created between moderate parties, the Ulster Unionist Party, the SDLP, there were moderate parties, and the assumption was that the centre ground would grow.
Mm.
And the irony is that the centre ground has grown. More people say they're neither unionist or nationalist. More people say they're both British and Irish to various degrees, Northern Irish, less concerned about the constitutional question. And yet the political system hasn't moved to accommodate that.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's still set up for, you know, an assumption of that binary two communities model. And so the segregation that we see in society here reinforces that to some degree. And this is why, you know, elections can be seen as like a sectarian head count, because that constitutional question is ultimately the one that the agreement seems to recognise as being the most important question.
That's what this guy was saying today, was that his daughter's boyfriend had to vote Sinn Féin, even though he didn't care about it.
Mm.
And I was saying, why can't, you know, it's a secret ballot, why can't you just vote however he wants? You see, you're laughing as well. It's like the most ridiculous question ever, but I still don't understand it. I don't understand how that sectarian headcount attitude prevails.
Because of the provision in the Good Friday Belfast Agreement for a border poll, if the Secretary of State thinks there's going to be a majority in favour of Irish unity. Right? So we have a really fascinating situation. And this, if you're interested in referendums and problems of sort of, you know, just getting over the line. This is a classic, because essentially for all the stuff about, you know, centre ground, you know, moving beyond that sort of fundamental sectarian tension, it's put the question of a majority, trying to find a majority for something, or a majority 50 plus one determining the future of a place, right at the core of the peace agreement. So in many ways it's an imaginative, innovative agreement. We have three strands, you know, unionist, nationalist, north, south, British, Irish. It's fantastic in that regard. But fundamentally, the idea that you get 50 plus one and then it's the constitutional status of Northern Ireland is determined, that's right there at the heart of it. And then, therefore, of course, you have a sectarian head count, because who's in the majority is absolutely key.
We've only been here 6 hours or whatever, 8 hours, and you really feel in those hours you never really understood this country on your doorstep. No matter how much you read about it, you really don't understand it until you're here and you talk to people about it and you listen and you see like this huge structure dividing communities right in front of you. Garrett Carr is the author of The Rule of the Land, Walking Ireland's Border, and is also based at Queen's University Belfast. His book is an exploration of the border as a distinct cultural and geographical place.
It'd be hard to say exactly when it started. I mean, I grew up quite close to the border, so in some ways I was prepared for it all my life, I suppose. There was something in the air. So although it was before the referendum and it was before the term Brexit had been invented, you did have UKIP and UK who are always talking about taking control of borders. And not just them, there was a sense that there was a sort of a rise of what sort of ethno-nationalism happening across the world, really. So I think in some sense I was responding to that, and this idea of the border seemed to be gaining importance. I was also just interested in exploring a place that wasn't even thought of as being a place, that was just thought of as being a problem and thought of in the abstract, a line in the landscape. There was kind of a concept rather than an actual location. And even people in Ireland sort of viewed it that way, instinctually. So I wanted to almost act like a, some sort of explorer and go and explore this region and show it to people. And it seemed like it was a great opportunity to treat a place as sort of undiscovered, because it kind of was. And so the border was this opportunity to go and discover a sort of new country. There was another reason as well, though, which had something to do fundamental with the landscape, in that if you start in the east, the border, it's a very hilly country, quite challenging country. South Armagh and sort of Monaghan, very hilly. And the border is usually down in little valleys, because a lot of the time it's following rivers. So it's always low and you're always impeded by hills. And it's quite an oppressive landscape. And it certainly would have felt very oppressive in times of conflict and dangerous. Great place to be ambushed. Great place to be harried. But as you go west, then the border, broadly speaking, rises. And when you get back to where I'm from, it's quite elevated country, a lot of it. It's bogland, highlands. We don't really use that term in Ireland, but that's sort of what it is. And so if you go from east to west, the border rises, the sky gets bigger, the horizon gets lower, and there's this sense of openness and sort of expansiveness occurs. And that's sort of what I wanted. I wanted a book that kind of started dark and sort of got lighter.
And is that reflected in any the politics of the places? I mean, we're visiting Newry and County Armagh tomorrow morning, and that has, I guess, like this, I don't know, quite famous, infamous site of really steep conflict during the Troubles, like lots of military checkpoints, stopped every few minutes and so on.
I was trying to tie everything together in a kind of continuum and look at the border, find its deepest root. And a conventional wisdom, certainly from a nationalist point of view, is that this, it's a sort of an artificial, imposed, foreign sort of scar. And, you know, there's a pretty good argument for that. But then, actually, you go to the ground itself and you discover places where the border seems to have evolved very gradually. And you can even go back into geological time almost to discover this. I mean, the most obvious point are the two lochs on each end of the border. You've got Lough Foyle and Carlingford, which are quite deep in Letts into the island of Ireland. And so the border follows them. So there is a sense that probably since before recorded history, people would have regarded this as the edge of a territory. There's also a really striking site, Quilca Mountain, which is between Cavan and Fermanagh. And it's the highest point of the border, although it's not very high. It's a long, narrow plateau. It looks a lot like a capsized ship. And the border was right over that and along the length of it and down the other side. And again, you look at that and you can see frontier in it. You can see that in prehistoric times, this would have been the edge of kingdoms, and indeed the written records seem to reflect that. So I suppose I just wanted to complicate it a little bit. I wanted to look at how deep borders can go, because it seemed to me there might be some sort of important truth there, if I could not exactly uncover it, but perhaps even find hints of it.
At the most basic level, there seems to be this steep contradiction of this kind of frontiers we have seen earlier today in Belfast, the peace walls, these extremely steep, man-made, physical infrastructure separating communities. And although we haven't been there yet, in the south, obviously now there's a completely open border, one that's totally contested now. And that just seems like a massive, striking sort of contradiction that you have this completely open place to the south that was previously securitized. And then here in Belfast, there's these vast physical infrastructures. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Yes, they are a contradiction, although they are also related. So peace walls in Belfast are sort of the enactment of the idea of the border. And there, it's sort of reflection. The peace walls in Belfast, if you go all the way down to their social and cultural roots, are rooted in this constitutional issue of Ireland's status into the future. Do we have a reunited Ireland, or do we stay in the Union? And that sort of fight is being symbolised in those peace walls. And Ireland's border looks like that as well. On the map, it looks like that as well. It's a line, you're on one side or the other, you're one finger or the other. It's this binary. So that was an important reason why I went to explore it. And it was an important reason why I felt I had to see it all and go on foot and explore it very closely, was because the peace walls in Belfast aren't actually a reflection of the border. They're a reflection of the idea of the border, the reflection of the concept of the border. If you actually go there, what you find are fields and rivers and actually a very bucolic and often very beautiful place. And so if you want to reflect the border in Belfast, you should just grow more trees and do some cattle farming. But this is actually what it looks like. What you actually discover on the ground is not a line. You discover a blurred, soft sort of place, a kind of a place onto itself as well. And there is no binary line there. There is, in fact, a kind of, I would argue, a sort of a culture and a living place.
Earlier that day, we had asked Katie what it would mean to be a unionist in a situation of Irish unity. If there was finally a united Ireland, would a version of the Good Friday Agreement still be necessary? Would you need to create a kind of new post-sovereignty situation? And how exactly would that work if indeed Brexit happened?
The interesting thing about the Good Friday Agreement on that fundamental matter about a border poll, which really got nationalists on board with the agreement, particularly, of course, Sinn Féin, that actually there are many questions that aren't even asked, let alone answered in it. The assumption would be that Northern Ireland would join the single nation state of Ireland. But there's also the possibility that the institutions like Northern Ireland Assembly and Executive could continue to exist. Because, of course, there's three strands of Good Friday. It doesn't make the Good Friday Agreement redundant. Mm. So the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement presumably could continue. But then that raises all sorts of other questions, because by that time there'd be a nationalist majority in the Northern Ireland Assembly. Would unionists be reassured by having a Sinn Féin-dominated Northern Ireland Executive, even if it is a power-sharing one, within a United Ireland? Or is there some other form of reassuring unionists in a United Ireland?
But then how could you even be a unionist in a United Ireland?
That's a really good question. So British identity in the UK is stronger in Northern Ireland than it is anywhere else in the UK. Mm. So that sense of Britishness means something here. And historically it has. You know, this wasn't something that's just come about since the Troubles, although it has increased since the Troubles. There is a distinctive identity that the Irish government and Irish nationalists to some degree have come to accept, that unionists aren't just Irish people who are slightly deluded, or, you know, they do accept that genuine British identity in a culture that is different. But yeah, you're right. What is unionist identity outside of the Union of the UK?
Well, we have other examples of diasporic groups or imagined communities or whatever we want to call them, are living within different sovereign conditions and retaining their identity. I suppose the problem in Northern Ireland is that it's always been loaded in terms of it's either moving in this direction towards Irish sovereignty, and or it's either maintaining
yes.
the status quo British sovereignty.
Yeah.
And then the Good Friday Agreement resolved that with a compromise that no one was happy with, but it was a classic compromise,
yeah.
you know, in that sense. So even though it's all about identity, it's politicised in such a way that makes it about sovereignty, and then it creates this weird post-sovereign environment.
That's the question, though. Is it like post-sovereign, sort of post-nationalist almost, or is it actually ultra-nationalist, ultra-sovereignty? Yeah. And I do think this is the thing with with the EU and the difference that the EU has made. If you look at the approach that the EU has taken to Northern Ireland, it's actually reinforced the significance of the British and Irish states in this. It said this is a problem between British and Irish. They don't expect it to be transcended by a sort of a new identity. It's actually reinforcing that nation-state model, that very crude nation-state model. And you see that in the agreement itself with that border poll.
For all the problems of the Good Friday Agreement, you only need to cross the border from the north to the south at Newry to get a handle on its great achievements. Most of all, there are no military installations. The last of them cleared away a decade ago. There are no border posts. The island of Ireland is genuinely open. At some point, the only indication you have that you are moving across the border is a sign explaining speed limits will now be in miles, not kilometres. No wonder Irish PM Leo Varadkar has warned a no-deal Brexit would see troops return to the border area to deal with the unfolding political and legal chaos. An ominous warning that London has frequently dismissed. That concludes the first part of our two-part special report. In part two, we explore the present political moment and the sources of optimism and hope.
I think it's time that people need to move beyond that, especially this past couple of years has shown that orange and green don't get us anywhere.
Yeah.
And people are sick of it.
To feedback to us on today's podcast, you can contact us as usual at podcast@anothereurope.org. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it or leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. As this is one of our special reports, there is no extra time this week. Members of Another Europe get access to extra material as a benefit of membership. This time, the whole podcast is free to all. We would, of course, still invite you to join the campaign and support the podcast. To do so, go to anothereurope.org/join. We'll be back very soon. See you then.